Yeah, I think we're good.
Excellent. Well, welcome everyone. It's a pleasure to see you all again. And of course, it feels a little different for me in a new role and trying to follow in Jeff's impressive wake and large footsteps and all of that. But I'll try and do my level best. I'll call the role in a moment here, but we thought it might be a nice idea if, as I called your name, if you could just give us a few seconds of introduction by way of who you are, what your daytime job is, and maybe just identify for some who might not be fully aware whether you are an incumbent or returning, and perhaps a different role. So with that, I guess I'll lead a bit. And again, I'm Chad Sarchio. I'm president this year. It's been a pleasure to serve as your president-elect, of course, over the past year. I'm looking forward to working with all of you. It was a great team last year. I'm sure it'll be an equally impressive team this year, just having had an opportunity to get even to know even just the newest folks a little bit during some of our welcome aboard calls and that sort of thing. So my day job is right now I'm acting as chief of staff for the administrator of the Drug Enforcement Administration, but ordinarily I do a bit of international intelligence law for the agency. And with that, let's turn to Jessica Adler.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jessica, and I am a solo practitioner family law attorney. I practice in all three jurisdictions, and I have been on my own for over 15 years now. Celebrated my big anniversary during the pandemic, and I am on my final sixth year term on the board, and I have enjoyed working with everyone very much.
All right. Thank you, Jessica. It's good to see you, or at least hear you. Katie's not with us, so Brian Flowers.
Good afternoon. I'm Brian Flowers. This is my first term, first meeting with the Board of Governors. Currently, I'm a Deputy Attorney General with the Office of the D.C. Attorney General, head of the Legal Counsel Division. Prior to that, in the D.C. government, I've been counsel to the mayor, counsel to the council, counsel to the D.C. Board of Ethics. I'm actually joining you today from Madison, Wisconsin, where I'm attending a Uniform Law Commission conference. A little mixed up with the time zone because my computer had a different time from my watch, from my phone. So, but I'm here with you now. Happy to be a member and join you.
It's fabulous to have you aboard, Brian, and you're in the right place at the right time. So you're spot on. All right. Next on my list is Sally Gear.
Hey, everyone. I am Sally Gear, and I am talking to you after my first airplane flight yesterday. And I am in lovely Sarasota, Florida, where I think it's probably cooler even than it is in DC. I am about to begin my second term on the board, and I am looking forward to another very positive 3 years. Thank you.
Thanks, Sally. Ted Howard.
Thanks, Chad. Hi, everyone. I'm Ted Howard. I am the pro bono partner at Wiley Ryan LLP in Washington. This is the beginning of my sixth year on the Board of Governors. I also serve as the, until August 6th, as the chair of the ABA Standing Committee on Legal Aid and Indigent Defense. And it's been a pleasure to serve on the board, and it's will be a pleasure to serve with all of you under Chad's leadership. Thank you.
Pleasure's all mine, Ted. Thanks very much. Janine Jackson. I'm not sure that I actually saw her smiling face on with us. Unless she's on the phone, but no, I think that's Peggy. Okay. Maybe she'll join us in progress. Ellen Jakovic.
Thank you, Chad. Hi, I'm Ellen Jakovic. I'm the new president-elect. Oh, no, no worries. Believe me, I have heard much more colorful pronunciations.
You don't need both.
Absolutely, no worries. I am thrilled to be joining the Board of Governors. It's so nice to see many familiar faces and also new ones that I hope to get to know more I am currently of counsel at Kirkland & Ellis, former partner. My practice area is antitrust, mergers and acquisitions. I am longtime active in DC bar associations, past president of the Women's Bar Association, and served two terms on the Board of Governors here a few years ago, one of them under the leadership of President Bob Spagnoletti. So that gives you some idea. But I am absolutely thrilled to be with you all and to be working with you this coming year and under Chad's leadership. So thank you so much. I'm thrilled for this opportunity.
Congrats again, Alan. It's great
to
have
you. Thank
you, Chad. Susie Ju.
Good afternoon, everyone. So Susie Ju, I'm legal director at Bread for the City. I've been at Bread for the City now for over 20 years. I started as a family law attorney there before I was legal director. And I am in my third year of my first term as a Board of Governor member or Board of Governors member. Now the only Susie, with Susie Hoffman rotating off. And anything else I need to share? And just looking forward to working with the incumbent board members again, incoming board members, and under Chad's leadership. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Susie. Someone who you've heard a little bit about, Jeff Kleinberg.
Hello, everyone. Jeff Kleinberg. I'm the immediate past president. It's my third year on the board. My day job is at a partner at Kellogg Hansen, where I do a mixture of sort of appellate and administrative law work. It's been a great pleasure and honor to serve as the president-elect and the past president. And I'm really looking forward to being the immediate past president under Chad's leadership. So thank you all. It's great to see you.
Thanks, Jeff. Natalie Koss.
Hi, my name is Natalie Koss. I'm the managing partner of Potomac Legal Group, where we handle employment law issues and civil litigation. And I am in my second year of my first term, and it's a pleasure to be on the Board of Governors with such great leaders and sharp minds. So it's a pleasure being here.
Thanks, Natalie. June Kress.
Hi, everyone. I'm June Kress. I'm a non-voting, non-lawyer member of the BOG, and I'm now in my third year of serving this great organization. I've been in the nonprofit sector for the last 35 years as a board member, board leader, and executive director of a local nonprofit called the Council for Court Excellence, and I was there for nearly 14 years. I still serve on numerous boards, and in my second career, I provide strategic advice to nonprofit executive directors on board of director challenges and governance, and I'm also serving as an executive coach. I'm a certified leadership coach, having gone back to school after I retired in 2017, and I'm delighted to see all of you today.
Thanks, June. I did note a certain extra gusto when you noted a non-lawyer, not just a non-voting member, a non-lawyer. I noted that. Anyway, Megan Lakini.
Good afternoon, everyone. Good to see everyone. And I'm looking forward to working with all of the new faces that I see here on this call. I'm Megan Lakini. I'm currently the Deputy Director for General Compliance at the Legal Services Corporation. If you do not know what we are, we're the largest federal funder of civil legal aid in the United States. I have started by serving as the DC Bar Treasurer, and now I am in my second term as a member at large. And I just want to particularly say it's good to see Ellen and her smiling face. We actually used to work together, so I'm looking forward to working with her again. And that's it for me.
Thank you, Megan. Again, Paul, I think Paul Lee will join us in progress. I think he's got a commitment during our first hour, so we should see him midstream. Lisa Lipsky.
Hi, good afternoon, Lisa Lipsky. I'm a senior audit partner with Grant Thornton, so also a non-lawyer, a non-voting member. I really like that, June. I'm going to use that, my tagline. So I've been with Grant Thornton for just celebrated my 24th year. So started when I was 12, happy to say, and this is my second year, first term, and happy to see everyone.
Thanks, Lisa. Andrea Mangones.
Hi, everyone. I'm Andrea Mangones. I am the Legal Director of Training and Technical Assistance at Kids in Need of Defense, or KIND, a national nonprofit organization that provides immigration legal services and social services to unaccompanied children. And prior to KIND, I spent 6 years at Latham & Watkins. I always like to tell this group that I started out my very first job, like true post-college job, was actually at OAH, DC's Office of Administrative Hearings. So I'm thrilled to be serving my first term as treasurer and to get to know and work with this incredible group of people. I'm just really grateful to be here.
Thanks, Andrea. I think Fatima Merchant will also be a little late, so we'll pass over her until she joins us in progress. So Peggy Lansbacher-Moore.
Thank you, Chad. Can you hear me?
We can hear you just fine.
Thank you. Thank you so very much. I'm Peggy Lansbacher-Moore. My day job, when I'm not working here with the Board of Governors, and this will be my second term, starting my second term with the Board of Governors. My day job, I'm the Labor Relations Officer at the Food and Drug Administration, which is part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And I've been in this position for 5 years, and prior to that, in the role of a employee labor relations specialist in the Office of Human Resources. And I'm also happy to report that for going on 20 years, Chad, I've been an arbitrator now for the Attorney-Client Arbitration Board of the DC Bar. And I also have a case coming up in August. So I'm busy in addition to being a member of the Board of Governors, but I'm delighted to be here.
Better busy than bored, that's excellent. All right.
Thank you.
You bet. Roger.
Hi, everyone. My name is Roger Lou Phillips. I'm the legal director at the Syria Justice and Accountability Center, and we're documenting war crimes and human rights violations in Syria, supporting prosecutions where possible. Previously, I was a UN legal officer at the Rwanda Tribunal and at the Cambodia Tribunal for a total of about 10 years. So I'm looking forward to joining this year for the first time as secretary and getting to know everybody. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Roger. Welcome again. Ramya.
Hello, everyone. Ramya Ravindran. I'm a partner at Bredhoff & Kaiser, which is a labor law firm doing primarily litigation work, also some employee benefits work. I guess I am officially today beginning my second year of my first term on the board, although I still feel new having not actually met any of you in person yet. So I'm looking forward to the day. It's been a pleasure so far on the board, and I'm looking forward to when we can get back to actually meeting in person.
Thanks so much, Ramya. And Diane, I think you're last and certainly not least today on the roll.
Oh, good. I'm here. Hello, everyone. I'm Diane Seltzer-Torrey. I was secretary last year and was lucky enough to get elected. So this is a season one, episode one for me without having to take minutes. So I'm kind of excited about that because we're away today and that's why my camera's off, but I got a little permission for that. So normally I would not hide behind the camera off function of a meeting. And during the day, when I am not involved with the board, I practice employment law. I have my own firm and I practice in Maryland and DC. And I'm also an adjunct professor at American at the law school where I teach right now in their Master of Legal Studies program. I teach human resources compliance. And I'm looking forward to when we all can meet in person, hopefully sooner rather than later. But I'm really excited to be working.
Thanks so much, Diane. Well, I see, as I'm sure all of you do on our agenda, we're obliged to convene in our first executive session and have a presentation by June Kress by way of introduction to our service on the board. So with that, let's reconvene in executive session.
Okay, thanks, Chad, very, very much. I want to thank Bob and Irem for suggesting that I spend a little time orienting you today to Nonprofit Board Service 101, what every BOG member needs to know. And I also want to thank members of the bar's marketing staff for making these absolutely gorgeous slides. So this afternoon, I'm going to cover the duties and the do's and don'ts of all nonprofit board members and what's expected of all DC Bar BOG members and when. And we'll have time for Q&A at the end, but don't hesitate to jump in with questions, and hopefully myself or Irem will provide an answer. So let's talk about the gold standard when it comes to board members' duties. And there are four standards. And those of you that may sit on other boards will probably recognize some of these. So I'm going to just quickly go through them. The duty of care means acting in good faith as a reasonable, prudent person would act under similar circumstances. Good board members are always informed, use common sense, and are diligent. It also means concrete things like attending all board meetings and committee meetings and fulfilling your responsibility to review financial records and to understand them as best you can. A board may delegate its duties, for example, hiring a consultant to perform an evaluation of its CEO or its executive director, but it must never abdicate its responsibilities because as board members, you have ultimate responsibility for the affairs of the organization. The second one is duty of loyalty. This means that a board member is obligated to act in the organization's best interests and not use his or her position to advance the interests of, say, a family member or another organization with which the board member is associated. Another aspect of duty of loyalty is that as a director, your actions must further the best interests of the organization as a whole, not just a particular constituency. So concretely, this means avoiding conflicts of interest and maintaining confidentiality of non-public information about the organization. And during the meetings, we will often talk about non-public information. In terms of avoiding conflicts of interest to satisfy the standard of duty of loyalty, board members are expected to disclose even the appearance of a conflict of interest, to abstain from voting if there is a conflict of interest or an appearance of such a conflict. And finally, should you believe there to be a conflict of interest on the part of another board member, it's your duty to act on this in order to satisfy the duty of loyalty. The third duty is the duty of obedience, and that refers to following the organization's purpose and goals as set forth in its bylaws and mission statement. It also means responsibility to obey any policies or procedures adopted by the board. And finally, to obey all federal, state, and local laws and regulations, and to take steps to ensure that the organization does this as well. And finally, the duty to inform. And this means that the officers of any organization have a duty to provide you, the board, with any material information they have learned while performing their duties. And it also means that officers must inform the board of any actual or proposed violation of board policies or violations of the law. And finally, you as directors must inform fellow board members of any wrongdoing as part of carrying out your duty of care to the organization. So these are the four duties. These are the gold standards when it comes to board members who serve both small and large organizations, and they certainly apply to the Board of Governors. In terms of other aspects of board service, I'm just going to mention three. Nonprofit directors are never compensated for board service, but may be reimbursed for out-of-pocket expenses incurred on behalf of the organization. So if a friend of yours says to you, please join my board and we're going to pay you a fortune for your service, that's a red flag because nonprofit board members are never paid for their service. Secondly, DC law generally limits director liability unless you've received a financial benefit from the organization to which you're not entitled, or if there is an intentional infliction of harm or violation of a criminal law, or if there is an unlawful distribution of the nonprofit's assets. Good bylaws always have a section on indemnifying their directors, and healthy organizations always have directors and officers liability insurance, known as D&O insurance. And finally, you'll be serving as a strategic advisor on a wide variety of matters pertaining to the DC bar and to the legal profession. And as for the delicate balance between providing direction and governance without being meddlesome, and I put an explanation point after that, I'll come back to this issue in the next slide. The next slide, please. Okay, so I'm going to talk briefly about the do's and don'ts of being a good governor, member of the Board of Governors. So you want to be prepared for all meetings by reading the material sent to you by Crystal. And typically there's a lot to read, and today is a very good example. I think it was 85 pages of stuff to read. So you need to look at the stuff ahead of time and be prepared. You want to be informed so you can make an informed decision when a vote is called. And we do a fair amount of voting. Questions are encouraged, so please don't hold back. And you will see that people ask lots of questions during the meeting, and that's just fine. And finally, you have been or will soon be asked to sign two conflict of interest forms, one for the BOG and the other for the Pro Bono Center, on which you will be asked to disclose any and all conflicts and or potential conflicts of interest. Let me say something about the don'ts. So this is one of the biggest challenges facing all board members and certainly facing all executive directors. That's the delicate balance I just mentioned, that of providing direction and governance on the part of the board without getting involved in the everyday affairs of the organization. That's what it means to be a meddlesome board member. We have, as you all know, a very seasoned, very effective CEO whose responsibilities include providing leadership to the DC bar staff. So as a member of the BOG and on any board you may serve, commandeering staff or getting into the weeds on the day-to-day functioning of the organization is just not appropriate. Second, while questions are encouraged for the sake of clarity, board members should not question the work done by the various BOG committees. Committee members have done the research, and when they present their findings and proposals, do ask questions, but please don't question their work. Please assume that they have left no stone unturned. And then finally, as a professional board, we use Robert's Rules of Order, so please don't ignore America's foremost guide to parliamentary procedure. And you should have received an easy to follow cheat sheet, and I urge you to study it. I know people say Robert's rules, it's too complicated. They're not complicated at all. So you've got that cheat sheet. Next slide. A few words about the DC bar bylaws. Some of you may know that the bylaws are now in the process of being updated. These bylaws and the bylaws of every nonprofit organization are meant to serve as a guide to the organization's actions and decisions, and they should always reflect how the organization actually functions. Bylaws should always outline the organization's authority levels, rights, and expectations, and our revised bylaws do just that. I've reviewed them and they're very, very good. In addition, the bylaws contain all the important sections on organizational purposes, BOG structure, roles and levels of authority, nominations and elections, committees, role of the CEO, and of course that's distinct from the board, amending the bylaws and protections for BOG members, including the all-important section on indemnification. Good bylaws are not too detailed, and typically they don't include policies and resolutions, which should always be kept separate from the bylaws. And many organizations keep a policies and resolutions binder for this purpose, and of course nowadays in electronic format. And finally, you can expect a final draft of the BOG's revised bylaws for your review and approval by the fall. So you'll all get a chance to look at them. I'm going to talk a little bit about your responsibilities as voting members. As mentioned before, you're expected to be informed on all matters coming before the BOG, and there are several votes at every meeting. Abstention is appropriate if you believe you have a real or potential conflict of interest, and in abstaining, it's important to state that as such. Abstention is not appropriate if you haven't done the work, if you haven't prepared, if you don't want to take responsibility for the issue, or if you're concerned about offending someone. You really do need to vote in a very informed way. So you can abstain, but these are examples where it's not appropriate. And just a word about voting. You know that 20 of you have been selected by the active DC board membership, but there are three of us who you've met who are not lawyers. I hope I didn't sound like anti-lawyer before when I put that in. I love, I've been lawyers my entire professional life. So I'm very honored to be serving in this capacity. We are appointed by the BOG to serve as non-voting members, and we all have three-year terms. We don't have a vote, but we certainly have a voice. So you will not see the three of us raise our hands or say aye. And it was at the first meeting of the BOG that I was so uncomfortable, because I was concerned by not saying aye and not raising my hand that people would think I wasn't paying attention. But in fact, that's our responsibility. It's to not have a vote, but to have a voice. Next slide. A little bit about the BOG committees. There are three standing committees: Audit, Budget, and Finance. And then there are ad hoc committees that are formed on an as-needed basis. The CEO Compensation Committee meets annually, while the other two were formed to handle specific reviews. That's the Bylaws Committee. And then 2 years ago, a committee was set up. I think we're ahead one slide.
That was my mistake. So that slide isn't there, but you should continue to talk about the committees.
Okay.
I'm sorry about that. Yep.
So that's okay. So 2 years ago, there was a committee that was formed to look into the idea of hiring or having an internal general counsel, a position that did not exist previously. So an ad hoc committee was formed and I was on it. We looked into it. And of course, that was the beginning of hiring Irem, for which we are so grateful. Unfortunately, many nonprofit boards never assess how they are governing, but I'm happy to report that the BOG will conduct a board self-assessment for the first time next year to assess our performance. And this is a really good example of how the BOG is a highly evolved, well-functioning board. Chances are this self-assessment will determine if the board is completing its work efficiently and effectively, if board members are engaged, and if committees are working properly, among other issues to be assessed. So you'll have a chance to see that in 2022. Now, a few words about the DC Bar Pro Bono Center.
June? I'm sorry to interrupt, but we're at 12:30. This is our hard stop so that we can have our judges join us for their remarks and for our swearing-in ceremony. And this is a great breaking point, I think, before we turn to the Pro Bono Center. So I think you did it just right. And we can return to complete this this presentation, June, in our second executive session, if that makes sense.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right, so with that, we'll exit our executive session and return an open forum for the judges of our local courts.
And we'll need to jump over to the other Zoom link, because that's the link that they have.
Okay.
All right, you should have a second one on your calendar.
I may not.
I'm not sure I do either. I think
It may have gone out just separately. Okay, so then we'll just stay where we are. I have two, because I think I received both, the one that went to the judges and the one that went to us
on
different times.
Bob, I can send it to this group. Should we do that? Because then otherwise, do you want the judges to join this call?
Which do they have, this link or the other link?
They have the other link.
This is Crystal. It's the same link. I just sent a separate calendar invite to the staff, to the chief judges, asking them to join at 12:30.
Yeah. Oh, it is 12:30 now, so they should be joining.
So we stay put, Crystal?
Yes. Yeah. Some of the staff are actually joining now on that same link, as you can see. So we have Dennis and some other folks joining at this point.
Yeah, I just jumped off and jumped right back on using the new link, and it brought me back to this.
Okay, perfect.
Chad, I noticed that Fatima has joined us. I don't know whether this might be an opportune time for her to...
Excellent point. Thank you, Jeff, for noting that. Fatima, welcome. While we, when we started our session, we just had a brief introduction. We took a moment to introduce ourselves. If you just want to tell us what your day job is and tell us how you're joining us, what your status is on this board.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, everybody. And sorry to be late, and like half of my face is numb right now, so I sound a little funny. I'm just thrilled to join you all. I was recently elected to the Board of Governors. I'm a partner at Shepherd Mullen. I'm an international trade and white collar investigations partner. So that's my day job. I do counseling and investigations and transactional work in international regulatory areas. I also serve on our firm's pro bono committee, and I am a co-leader of our Attorneys of Color Network, as well as our office's diversity working group. And I have been really involved in affinity bar associations in the district. And 2 years ago, I was president of the Capital Muslim Bar Association. So I have been able to, I've gotten a chance to meet some of you, but I look forward to getting to know all of you and learning from you, because I'm new, and I'm excited to learn about my role and really serve the DC legal community. So thank you. But I will follow the do's and don'ts. I will not commit.
Thank you so much, Fatima. Welcome aboard. I see that Chief Judge Anita Josie Herring has joined us. Hello, Your Honor.
Hi, how are you? I hope I'm not, am I here at the wrong time? I feel, am I? Okay, great.
That's right.
Great, thank you, Karen.
Very nice to have you with us.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, what a, another leg of the race, right?
Well, I think we're all maybe starting to tire of two dimensions and looking forward to three, and maybe we're almost there. So, but, you know, we'll get this down just in time to abandon this platform, I guess.
You know, Chad, it might make sense if Chief Judge Blackburn Rigsby is running a few minutes late, you can maybe start with your president's report. We can always interrupt it if the chief joins us,
or sure,
when the chief joins us.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. So I honestly don't have a lot for the group. I thought I'd talk a little bit about the year ahead, just in the odd chance that maybe you didn't actually watch the celebration of leadership and induction ceremony and my amazing remarks. They were not that amazing, but just a brief recap of what I think we're probably going to be focused on in the year ahead. Recognizing that my crystal ball isn't any better than most people's. What I think I'd like to focus on, and I think what we'll be obliged to focus on, I often note that what I talked about sort of on the campaign trail, if you will, is not what the world had in store for us, given the challenges of the last 16-18 months or so. But I think what we're obliged to do is really figure out how to get back to work, both as a bar organization, but in all of our individual practices, and frankly, on a more personal level as well, because I think we all know all too well how challenging it was on all of those levels for us to come to the work that we do here with the bar, but all of our regular practices and other associations in a world that looked nothing like what we had known before. I kind of noted on the night of the induction that we didn't have any blueprints when we did this going in one direction, and we can't easily reverse engineer any of this, I don't think, either. We're really fortunate, I think, to have some very astute thought leaders in this space, most especially Bob. I think his leadership and some of the interactions, I know the interactions that he's having within the community of CEOs of the bars is really going to be an incredible resource for us. So I think we're well positioned to make the transition back to a more ordinary course of business will be one that we can manage. And so I look forward to trying to share with our members the best practices that we can devise and to assist them as we can. The second point that I thought we will quite obviously have to turn our attention to is the amazing crush of pro bono need that the neediest in our community are likely to face. We've been fortunate to get in place some well-attuned moratoria, and those protections will be expiring across a range of issues in, you know, the landlord-tenant space, debt relief space, and all of those kinds of areas. And I think it's fair to say that people who have done this far longer and with far greater depth of expertise than I have had know that we're going to see need unlike what we've ever seen before. We're really, again, fortunate to have folks who are on the cutting edge of how to leverage the pro bono resources and tools and technology that have sort of been brought to bear during the pandemic to try and make this in some ways, find a silver lining in the cloud and to make us effective on the back end. But it's going to take a lot of effort and thought to get right. And so that's really a piece that we're going to have to press aggressively, I think, with our members. And I hope to be a cheerleader for that in every way I can. Finally, the thing I noted as a priority during this year ahead is going to be, I think, a focus, maybe a slightly sharper focus on attorney wellness, because I don't think there's been a time quite like the one that we've gone through in terms of how much we've asked of ourselves and how much is and will be asked of us by our communities, by our practice, in our practice settings, and with all of those people around us in our personal lives. And so I hope that we can find some important, unique, innovative ways to bring attorney wellness more fully into the picture in our bar and our way of doing business. But with that, I see that Chief Judge Anna Blackburn Rigsby has also joined us. And without further delay, I'd love to turn to the Chief Judge for our swearing in, our formal swearing in as a board, and for the remarks that both of our wonderful judicial leaders are prepared to provide. Welcome to you both again. It's so nice to see you.
Thank you, President Sarchio, and to our wonderful Board of Governors and officers of the DC Bar. I apologize for joining you a few minutes late. I hope you are all well, and I appreciate President Sarchio's remarks about wellness and how important it is. And I think it takes on a new meaning when we say to each other, "How are you doing?" To be mindful and present to really hear and see how folks are doing. And that's been a little harder to do in this virtual environment. And as we begin to emerge and have the opportunity to see each other, to greet each other, and even to hug each other, which we've missed for the past 14 months, I think that is so important. And I will just share on my own end, many of you, particularly our former bar presidents and leaders, knew and interacted from time to time with my very long time judicial administrative assistant, Ms. Laverna Teba. And we worked together for 26 years since I've been at the court on the bench, and she passed away Sunday. So it was just a personal loss for me and for our court family. And I apologize, I've been on the phone with her family and just 26 years worth of law clerks that she also nurtured and mentored. So that wellness piece is so important to all of us. I am happy to be here. I wish we were sitting in the bar conference room, enjoying a wonderful, delicious lunch, especially the cookies. hello to Chief Judge Josie Herring. And I think along with Chief Judge Josie Herring and our court leadership team, we have been trying to be very mindful and to, as we like to say, lead with empathy. When we first had to pivot at the beginning of the pandemic to an online platform to guide our more than 1,200 staff and managers and judges through this process, And keeping in mind that there have been many losses, but there have also been many joys and many accomplishments, many innovations. And as we talk about reimagining the courts, as we emerge from this pandemic, we don't see going back to normal. We see a new normal that has many, many opportunities for innovations and for rethinking how we do many things, for carrying with us some of the innovations, particularly with technology that we had to pivot to during this pandemic. But we also recognize, as some of you have heard me say, and that the increased reliance on technology has also exposed further the digital divide we have along income disparities and the lack of access to certain kinds of reliable technology. And the courts are mindful of that as we move forward. I will take a moment to just remind you all of the wonderful remote access centers that we have in every quadrant of the city so that parties to court proceedings in the trial court and even for oral arguments and hearings in the Court of Appeals can sign up to use those so that they have a safe and reliable place to participate in a court proceeding. We've had some outreach and engagement sessions with many of our court stakeholders. And you can stay tuned that we want to do that more going into the future. And Chief Judge Josie Herring may talk about it in her remarks, but one of her visions was that we, the court convene town hall meetings in the community. And we often participate when these are hosted, but we think it's important for the courts to lead out on this, particularly as people are wondering how the courts will move forward in the future. And July 12th, yesterday, marked a significant milestone where we further increased the on-site presence in all of our court buildings, specifically in all of the court's public offices in every division in the trial court, as well as our public office and public-facing services in the Court of Appeals offices. And we're going to continue to do that gradually and safely so that the public feels more comfortable and knows that they are safe coming into our buildings and that our staff who are returning to on-site work know that. But we also want to hold on to some of the innovations and flexibility that people have said have worked well during this pandemic. So I just want to say a special shout out to Jeff Kleinberg as our immediate past president. It was a pleasure working with you in a year like no other, as so many have said. And to Chad Sarchio, I am excited about your term and want to continue the close collaboration that the courts and our bar have together. We have come through a lot together. And each time we say, what's going to happen this year? Something very interesting has happened. So I don't want to say that for your term, Chad. I do appreciate your focus, Chad, on continuing the work of Jeff Kleinberg on pro bono services, specifically with the Court of Appeals. I know the bar has done phenomenal things in partnership with the Superior Court, with Chief Judge Josie Herring. But there is a growing need for pro bono services at the appellate level as well. We are actually seeing a surprising number of unrepresented appellants in our court who are trying to navigate that process. And so pro bono services are wonderful there. And we also appreciate the training and collaboration to train mediators to handle pro bono cases for those litigants who want to mediate at the appellate level, because we can't do it unless both sides are represented at the appellate level. So I'm excited. I also feel strengthened and very fortunate and blessed to have emerged from this pandemic healthy. And I am glad to see that all of you have as well, because we know that everybody wasn't. And to me, that imposes a greater responsibility on us to take what we've learned, the resilience, the fortitude, and to go forward, because there are so many in need as we emerge from this pandemic. So we need you at the bar. I'm so proud of our District of Columbia bar when I have the opportunity to meet with my colleagues at other state courts around the country, because we have so many innovations. We have an unwavering commitment to pro bono service in our bar like no other. And, you know, I feel bad that we're always saying, but we need more. But the truth is, we do need more from you. When you look around and you have such a talented bar, yet we still have the disparities along race, ethnicity, language barriers, and income access in right here in the nation's capital. So there's much more to be done, and we need each and every one of you. And we are honored as the courts to work with you. I just wanted to say a bit on judicial vacancies at the Court of Appeals continue to persist. As you may be aware, there are three vacancies that have been advertised and pending. We have a nominee for one of those. That was the longest vacancy, 7 years plus vacancy on our Court of Appeals. And Tova Calderon has been nominated and is pending at the Senate. There are two additional vacancies, one for the seat of Judge John Fisher, who retired last August, and one for the seat of Judge Phyllis Thompson, who will take senior status in September. And we're waiting for nominees for those two seats. So I will stop there, but needless to say, when you're down two vacancies, that's 25% nearly of a 9-judge court, and it has impacted our ability to timely serve the parties before us. I don't want to take too much time, and since I know that you have a full program here, I did want to mention that the bar exam is coming up. This will be the third remote bar exam administered. As many of you know, we administered the very first remote exam in October. It was not a uniform bar, but our wonderful staff negotiated individual agreements with over 13 jurisdictions so that there would be some reciprocity. The February remote exam was a uniform bar exam, and we had a record number of examinees take and pass that exam. And the July exam will be a remote uniform bar exam. And at this point, we have more people registered for the July bar exam than we ever have, nearly 2,400 registrants. I'm happy to answer questions. I just want to thank you all for your continued support and collaboration of our DC courts, but mostly for your unwavering commitment to serving, particularly the needs of those who desperately need but can't afford legal representation in our jurisdiction. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chief Judge.
Am I supposed to swear you in now, or was I supposed to do that first? Sorry.
Now is this perfect time, just as good as any.
Speaking of innovations, I've completely reinvented your agenda for the day, and I apologize for that.
Flexibility, so, we've learned over the past time period here is key, so we're with you.
Okay, so I want to make sure that I have your oath here, if you give me one moment, and then we can have all of our Board of Governors folks. Let's see, where's my oath? Okay, have it here before me. All right. It's lovely to see all of your faces. And if I could ask those members of the Board of Governors, hi, Bob Spagnoletti, I wanted to say hello now that I've opened up my screen. I see you. Thank you for your leadership on the administrative side of the DC Bar. So if I could, one last thing. Thank you all for the first ever virtual Judicial Bar Conference. We got wonderful feedback, and it was fantastic. And I want to thank the bar staff and the team, our own Judge Deal, who chaired it along with Judge Easterly and others. So thank you. All right, if the members of the Board of Governors would please, I'm gonna show off a little bit with one of our technological innovations. If you've seen any of our virtual oral arguments, we use this fancy backdrop, so we'll make it more official. If you all would please raise your right hands and repeat after me. Please state your name.
Jeffrey
Sargio.
Hi, Susie Jew.
Do solemnly swear or affirm.
Do solemnly swear or affirm.
That I will faithfully.
Faithfully.
And impartially.
Faithfully
uphold.
And impartially.
Execute the duties. Of an elected official.
Of the District of Columbia Bar.
I will perform those duties.
In conformity with the rules.
Of the District of Columbia Court of Appeals. And the bylaws of the District of Columbia Bar.
And this I promise.
And I will stop there. You know, your official oath goes on and on, but given the delays, I think it would take us about an hour to get through it. I just want to say you are duly sworn and ready to get to work. So I am proud of your continued service. Many of you are continuing on in an additional term. Some of you are new, but this is a labor of love. And I know you all have jobs that are busy and demanding. Thank you. Chad, you have a wonderful team. I wish you all the best and we will be in touch. You know, I've had a tradition, as Bob knows and Jeff and some of the other past presidents who may be on the call of regular informal as well as formal communications. And I look forward to that with you.
Thank you so much, Chief Judge. And I can promise you, we will try to make positive progress and maybe cross the finish line with the pro bono initiative at the Court of Appeals. Absolutely.
Thank you very much. And I'll still look forward to that lunch at some point before your term is over. So, especially the cookies.
Absolutely, Chief. We'll make sure it happens.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Is there anything else that I'm that you need me to do at this time?
I don't think so. I think we're all set, Your Honor.
All righty. Well, have a great and productive meeting and an excellent term. Thank you all for inviting me.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Without further ado, then, I'd like to turn to Chief Judge Anita Josie Herring to provide us some remarks with regard to the Superior Court.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to your Board of Governors meeting where all of you have just gotten sworn in, obviously not Bob, because he's an administrator for the bar and well-known and a great, great leader. And there may be others on the administrative side, but to those of you who were just sworn in, we know that you are truly committed and empathetic. And our community depends on really the talent of the lawyers, the talent of the bar, the talent of those or talents of those who volunteer to really focus on the courts, which really is sort of the emergency room in many cases for our community. And we are here to answer questions in the court. We have lots of issues to resolve in the varying divisions or the various divisions of the court, and we have a very strong bench. Of course, we're down about 12 judges, and that has been difficult for us. And of course, all of us have been living through the pandemic and dealing with the other social issues and other issues that prevail in our community and our country that have made our lives heavier as we try to forge through one thing after the next and continue to move forward. But I believe, and you know this well, the community depends on all of us to be concerned because many of us could have great careers and go on with our lives and completely disengage. But I think we have been very intentional and decided to use our talents in a way really for the betterment of this community and beyond. I want to thank outgoing or immediate past president Jeffrey Kleinberg for his commitment to access to justice, obviously, which involves pro bono efforts, and for being an outstanding leader and putting the bar in a great position as the institution continues to emerge from the pandemic. And as you have passed the baton on to our president, 50th president, Sarcio, Mr. Sarcio, we know with all the discipline you have from your military experience, but your other legal talents as well, that you will lead the bar still in a great direction and will do great things. And in fact, we look forward to seeing what you will do as a leader who will focus on some of the things you just mentioned, wellness, as we recognize mental health as a big issue, as we all have worked hard through the pandemic. Some of us have staffs and others that we have had an opportunity to talk with, our family members and others who have really had to struggle as we have had less communication in person, less social time, and really been working remotely in our homes. But as we bounce back from all of that, Chief Judge Blackburn Rigsby explained that this week, yesterday was the first day that all of our public facing offices are fully staffed. We had offices that were staffed, but they're 100% fully staffed at this point. And we have a number of staff here, and we always have been operating, but we're increasing our operations month after month as we look at the metrics, the COVID metrics, and really strive to return to full operations physically in the courthouse. You should know we are managing our caseload well. We have not had as many jury trials as I would like. We've had two. We're in the middle of one that is in progress in the criminal division. So that would be the third when that finishes. Ironically, it was a trial that I had to stop just before closing argument after being in trial for 3 weeks due to the pandemic. But Judge Kravitz is finishing it off or starting it over. And so that's in progress right now. We are expected to have a trial in the civil division next week. We have disposed of a number of cases that would have been trials, certainly in the criminal division, because of pleas or dispositions on that side. So we are doing well. We have not just sort of stood in place. I think people equate trials with action or progress, but dispositions, quite frankly, are a shorter way to getting to the end of a case if there's a will by people to do it. And on the civil side, we've had lots of settlements in cases. In fact, our mediation multi-door dispute resolution division has been super active, and I think they're doing better than we were doing during normal times. So we're really doing all that we can do to continue the work of the court. But we know that you, each of you, are critical partners in our ability to really understand what the needs of the community are and to focus on those needs. And we need you, obviously, as it relates to helping out with legal services in cases in which so many people living in our very prosperous city don't have. As I walk around the city, as I get out from time to time, I'm always amazed at all of the new things that exist, you know, on the waterfront, you know, the ballpark, you know, in the neighborhoods that have mostly been renamed or named for the first time. And the stark, there's a stark contrast when you think about a lot of people who actually were living in the city and have been for many years, but are poor. And this reminds us that while some of us are doing well, there's a great need, and we're all here to serve the community. And you've been doing that, I know, in various ways for so many years. But I do think with all the prosperity we have and that we can participate in, we hope for others that they can share in this new vision and reality of the city, and we can all benefit. And for some of them, that means, you know, having the ability to address financial issues, whether it's debt, whether it's housing, or some other matter, whether it's domestic violence. People who don't have access to lawyers or access to resources need to know that the bar is there to help them, because quite frankly, without a lawyer, or certainly who knows what will happen or what could happen in a very important case. And I take the position that each case is important to the person who is involved in that matter, even if we don't think it's sort of the biggest case really to talk about. The other thing that's important to realize is that for some people, if they lose a case, they lose housing. If they lose a case, their debt may be such that their credit is impacted for a very long time. And that might put them in a position, quite frankly, of not being able to be the resource they need to be for their family otherwise. And so it's so important for the bar to step in, as you have done many times, to fill that gap. And in the recent past, pro bono service has been at a great height, in the sense that so many law firms and others have contributed a vast amount of sort of talent and resources to ensuring that people without attorneys have access to lawyers or access to advice. And so for that, we are very grateful in the court system. It's better, of course, to have people who are represented by lawyers who are competent than to struggle before the court without a clear understanding of that process. And so we thank you for everything that you do. We know you'll continue to do great things. And like Chief Judge Blackburn Rigsby indicated, our doors are always open. If you have questions or concerns, we want to keep the lines of communication open here at the Superior Court for you to give us feedback. And we know that we're always engaged with the bar because we have stakeholders everywhere in all the different aspects of the court. But if you really have a concern, please reach out to me and I'd be happy to talk with you, because I'm only here to try and improve our system for others. And I know you're doing what you're doing for the same reason. Thank you.
Thank you so much for those remarks, Chief Judge. While we have you, I'm sorry, I have to ask one question. I'm just wondering how your reopening of the public counters at the courts went, whether there were any particularly notable stories or reports from the field, so to speak, as to how all of that went yesterday.
Well, I can tell you, I believe, I don't know, have the numbers, and I think the executive office is tracking that, but I've been coming in and out of the building for the last 2 days. We just reopened those public counters yesterday. I can report that I've seen increased numbers of people coming in the building. And I do have some information from the domestic violence unit. I believe we had a very high number of individuals accessing the domestic violence clerk's office and the various services yesterday. So that's what, that's the state of my information about what's happening with the return. As you mentioned earlier, you know, we all enjoy the flexibility of not being at work full time, because even if we didn't think we could work at home, once we figured out we could, we threw something in the dishwasher and, you know, we're still on the computer and doing, you know, some other things, or we got to sleep a little longer before we, you know, went on to a virtual meeting, or, you know, I changed clothes by putting on a jacket to attend an evening event without stepping out of the room. So those were all wonderful things, but we do know we need an in-person presence in our buildings. Certainly, I don't want other people to take our buildings because we're not occupying them. That's my concern. But the other thing is we're in the business of dealing with people. And so there has to be that personal handoff and a personal touch. On the other hand, we want to make it flexible for our staff to do their work and to stay healthy and mentally and otherwise. And if giving them some flexibility in their schedules is what it will take to achieve that, we certainly have it in our plan to increase flex time and other ways of working so that people, that is everyone in the court system, including judges, can take advantage of that to some extent.
Well, thanks for those additional insights. Obviously, we wish you good luck with that process, because returning to work is obviously a pretty complex process when you're talking about working at the courthouse. And obviously, the bar is here to support and partner however we can.
Thank you very much. Well, I am going to sign off because I have a meeting with the probate division. I scheduled these half-hour meetings, three on one day, for another day with the divisions. And every time I'm like, wow, it's time for another meeting. So I have to go. I hope you have a productive day, and thank you for giving me the time. And Mr. Kleinberg, you're not gone yet, because see, here you're on the Board of Governors. You see what happens. Okay. And you, Mr. Starcio, bye guys. Thank you.
We're very grateful. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. With that, before we jump to the consent agenda, I just thought I'd do two things. One, welcome Paul Lee to the call. Paul, we went around the horn with just a few seconds of introduction. Maybe you could just tell us what you do with your day job and tell us about your status on the board.
Sure. Hey, everybody. My name is Paul Lee. I'm the pro bono counsel at Steptoe & Johnson. And I am starting my fourth year on the Board of Governors and the third of my three-year term. So great to see everyone. Welcome.
Good to see you again, Paul. Thanks so much. The other thing I thought I'd do is just to finish off the president's report that I broke so that we could join the chief judge, is just to note a little bit of a preview. And you've already heard reference to it. Coming soon this fall, you will have a report on the process and the work being done on the revisions to and reimagining of our bylaws. And that's going to, I think, really be important in so many ways, maybe a few more ways, which June will describe during the balance of her presentation. But you'll also note one of our agenda items that's upcoming related to the extension and a couple of extensions related to our fees. That sort of experience it's really not necessary for us to have to confront in these meetings. And in the future, if we complete the process that's in play the way we anticipate, I think you won't see that kind of more, I don't know, administrative routine kind of work coming to the board. So that is a really important effort that's been afoot for some time. Iram, our general counsel, and others have been leading a really thoughtful and meticulous effort. And so we look forward to that. I just wanted to drop that little bit of a preview into my report. But with that, I think we can move to the consent agenda with a small caveat. You may be looking at an agenda that has an appointment to the DC Judicial Nomination Commission still as a part of the consent agenda, but we removed it to give it an opportunity for some discussion on that topic. But the balance of the consent agenda, of course, you have all of the attachments in tab 6, and that includes our secretary's report and the minutes from our June 8th meeting. A series of committee assignments and appointments. And I'll thank you right now for the hard work to come that all of you will put in those positions, and a couple of relatively straightforward updates to the community's policies and procedures. If there are any questions about anything on the consent agenda, of course, we can field that now. Otherwise, if there's an motion to adopt the consent agenda with that one caveat of what we removed, I'd entertain it.
I move the adoption of the consent agenda.
Is there a second? Noting that, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? All right, with that then, the consent agenda has been approved. Think it makes best sense then, Bob, I think you'd agree, turn to the Judicial Nomination Commission?
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Okay, well, if you've had an opportunity to look through your materials, you see that Vince Cohen has been, is the person I proposed for appointment to the commission. I think if you look through his materials, you see he is very well experienced in our local courts and has practiced in a number of settings and has sort of literally a lifelong DC resident and committed to our courts and the cause of justice in the city. But if there is discussion and or questions that anybody has, please, now's the time for us to discuss.
Okay. If it's all right, I'll start, Chad. Since I'm at least, I think, one of the people who asked to have this taken off the consent agenda. I just want to make sure that the bar is being very intentional in its two appointees that it has on the DC Judicial Nomination Commission. And for anyone who is not particularly familiar with it, that is the body that makes recommendations to the president for appointment to the Superior Court and to the DC Court of Appeals. We are now in the position, I guess, of filling an unexpected vacancy. I think that, at least from, although I'm retired now, I consider myself still kind of plugged in. And one of the concerns that I have heard about the current Judicial Nomination Commission is that it is populated by individuals who do not have much experience in either Superior Court or the DC Court of Appeals, and yet they are being asked to make recommendations for those positions. So I think that's one factor to keep in mind. Another factor, as I think is probably clear to anyone who has worked in a small group or a trial team, the Judicial Nomination Commission has 7 members. It's a very time-consuming and busy position to hold, but it is also critical that the person that we consider to appoint is someone who can work well with others, someone who is collegial, because I believe that is another important aspect of the service. And my final comment, and I should say, none of what I am saying is to say that I would not support the proposed appointee. I have met him. I don't know him. I certainly, think he has an impressive record. But we will be in another 6 months asked to identify a new or a second appointee. And so if there are criteria that we as a Board of Governors believe are important to share with the screening committee, kind of now is the time to start looking at that and thinking about it, rather than, having to say, oops, now we got to decide, based on very short notice. So is that, and Brian probably will back me up on this, but the District of Columbia and the Office of the Attorney General for the District of Columbia are the most significant repeat parties in our local courts. And to me, at least at some point, we should be looking at people who, you know, whose daily lives are spent in the courts and, you know, are well positioned to make recommendations. Now, obviously, making a recommendation also means you're plugged in enough to the local legal community that you know who to recommend and how to do it. So that's another part that would be important for us as a Board of Governors is, you know, how do we identify people, or how does the screening committee identify people? But the Judicial Nomination Commission has in the past been more heavily staffed by U.S. Attorney's Office representatives. And I just think it's time to broaden that representation to include our local government representation. And again, I'm a former AUSA, so I have nothing against AUSAs for sure either. So again, you know, my point is, this is so important to the bar, so important to the members of the bar, and so important to our community that we have good judges that instill faith in the administration of justice in our city. So that's why I wanted to have a fuller discussion. So thank you.
No, those are all fabulous points, Sally, and I'm very glad that you wanted to approach it this way and gave voice to all of that. I also take your point that your arguments in favor of all of those kinds of criteria are not an argument necessarily against Vince. Perhaps just to amplify a couple of points in particular for our newest members, I'll just say that, you know, Vince had, albeit from the from positions within the U.S. Attorney's Office, he spent more than 11 years in our courts. That doesn't mean just in sort of a figurehead kind of a role, although he was the acting U.S. Attorney for a time period. He was very much in the trenches, both in criminal and civil matters, both in the trial and appellate courts. He's practiced in small firm and large firm settings in the city. He has been very involved with a number of other organizations dedicated to the causes of justice, the cause of justice in the city. And I think it's fair to say he, in some ways, he is a, kind of the ultimate collaborator, because I take your point too that we really do need someone who can be collegial and dedicated to the work of the commission. It's a fun little factoid about Vince, that he was a member of his collegiate basketball team in Syracuse. And that really says, I think, all you need to know about sort of the team-focused perspective that he brings to all of the work that he does. It's kind of who he is at his core. So, you know, it's so tough to find, like in any of these scenarios, the one person who does everything for every important criteria that you might imagine for a key role like this. But I have great confidence in Vince, and in many ways, I think, you know, the materials that you see there speak for themselves. I guess the other thing worth noting was that when the screening committee took up the appointment for the person he's replacing, he was actually, essentially a finalist in that list. So, you know, Vince comes with that bit of support, you might say, as well. Enough talking here. I see at least two hands. Bobbers may have gone up first.
Could I just add, I'm sorry, one more truly final point. And that is, again, that we are focused, as we certainly should, on our appointee, but I think we also need to step back and look at who else is on the Judicial Nomination Commission. And as I recall, the last time when we ended up with Deborah, one of the considerations was that there was only one woman lawyer on the commission. And that will unfortunately remain the same if, you know, we proceed with the appointment at this time. again, not to, to counsel against it, but more to raise people's awareness that in December, when we are trying to make recommendations or reach decisions, that, you know, we have to look not only at the individual, but at the group in which they are going to be participating. All right, now I'm final. Sorry.
No, again, great points. Thank you, Sally. Bob, like I said, I think you might have been next.
I think Susie actually had her hand up first.
I'm sorry, Susie.
Thanks, Bob. I have a comment and a question. My comments are that I support all that Sally has pointed out. And one thing I wanted to add is I'm disappointed to see that Deborah Epstein had to resign, because one of the things that she presents is something that is not, I don't believe, currently reflected on the Judicial Nominations Commission, which is someone who has experience on the civil side, in the courts where there are considered high volume, so-called high volume court, pro se courts, where many of the litigants are unrepresented. And it's an important part of a judge's tenure to be serving on those parts of the court, and knowing how to have the right temperament and understanding of how justice is dealt in those parts of the court. And Deborah had that experience and has that experience as a litigator and supervising a clinic that practices an domestic violence unit. And so that is something that I think is very important. I think it's part of a judge's job that candidates may not focus on. And having someone with that understanding on the Judicial Nominations Commission is really critical, particularly to the extent that this Board of Governors is filling a slot, and to the extent that we are concerned about access to justice, particularly for those who are unable to secure a free lawyer or pay for a lawyer. And so that is something I think we need to consider. My question is whether or not can the commission not execute its duties unless it's fully constituted?
I know the answer. I mean, it can, in fact, complete its duties. Obviously, they're one person short, but the volume of work that they have to do is enormous. And because they share some of the burden of going through the voluminous applications, and I can tell you this, is that the DC bar appointees are usually looked at as the workhorses of the commission. As the ones who sort of plow through it all. And so while they certainly can vote on folks and move it forward, they are really, especially given the number of vacancies that are going on right now, they really are at a disadvantage. And they rely on, quite frankly, the DC bar candidates for insight into what the Superior Court needs. And so they're losing that critical voice. So they've made it very clear to us, that is Judge Sullivan as the chair of the commission, that they are eager to have somebody on board as soon as possible, and also to have a person ready to be appointed when Mr. McAvoy's term expires at the end of the year.
Yeah, I guess my concern is that this person is still going to be there for a number of years. And to your point, Bob, if the commission members are looking to this person about what the needs of DC Superior Court is and are, I'm not sure this person can reflect what all those needs are.
Well, if I can on that score, I mean, I've known Vince for a very long time. And he was in the sex offense and domestic violence section handling domestic violence cases for, I mean, probably more than a year in a high volume capacity. He also was a civil litigator, both in the Superior Court and the U.S. District Court. And so he's got, I think, both of those. He clerked also for Judge Long. Now, it's some time ago, of course, but I believe she was on the civil calendar when he was doing his clerkship. And then, of course, he was the principal deputy U.S. attorney when they were putting lots of the procedures in place to handle the DV cases in particular, and the related civil protection order and child custody cases that will roll through there from time to time. So again, he certainly doesn't have the depth of personal experience that Deborah Epstein does, you know, managing the cases day in and day out, but he certainly comes to it with a significant awareness of that. going into it, and certainly more so than the other folks who were on the list of people who had volunteered. In fact, that's, he and Deborah Epstein were, you know, among the two finalists. And I think that for the reasons that you mentioned, Susie, as well as to put some more gender diversity onto the commission, that was part of the reason that the board at the time approved Deborah's nomination or appointment to the commission.
Yeah, I guess I still think that despite his experience in the criminal side of the domestic violence unit, it's still very different in the civil side where you're dealing with unrepresented litigants. And that's not a perspective I feel like it's being reflected on this Judicial Nominations Commission.
If I can,
I also understand that there's an issue of just trying to find the people who are willing to step into this role. And I think that's our challenge as a Board of Governors for so many positions, and particularly this important position.
And if I can, that's actually the second point I wanted to make, which is, I think that it really is a responsibility of all of us, staff and members of the Board of Governors, to be out there recruiting candidates. This is a particularly difficult one to fill because it's a 6-year commitment. You've got to be a resident of the District of Columbia, and this is controlled by a statute, so it's not as if we can waive any of these requirements. And significantly, the person is ineligible to apply to be a judge, either in the Superior Court or the DC Court of Appeals, for a period of 2 years following their service on the commission. So a lot of folks who are really invested in the court system have potential judicial aspirations of their own. And I know from my own personal outreach, a lot of folks have said thank you, but no thanks, as I might want to apply for a judge in the next 3, 4, 5 years. So just keep in mind what the requirements are. But everyone, I think, shares in the collective responsibility in recruiting folks. You know, as Sally said, you know, those of us who have played in the system know who you might want to focus on and who might not, or know people who will know who to focus on and not to focus on. So I do think that that's worth remembering as we go forward. And we do have this other vacancy that'll happen at the end of the year. And we have time to find good recruits, have them run through the screening committee, and which is now constituted. And then we'll be able to present back to the board for appointment by the end of the year.
Ellen, I see you've got a virtual hand up as well.
Sorry, there, unmuted. Thank you, Chad. And thank you, Bob. You answered some of the questions that I had. Part of the reason for raising my hand was I did have some questions and also some comments. I guess a final question also is, I just want to make sure how Vince came to us. It sounds like the screening, well, maybe I'll let you tell us, Bob or Chad.
Yeah, so when we had the vacancy that occurred back in 2019, we advertised, as we always do, and we solicited, as we're currently doing now for Mr. McAvoy's vacancy. Vince volunteered. He put himself in there with his materials. He was vetted. The screening committee met, as it always does, with the president, who makes the recommendation. And so it got narrowed down to Vince, Deborah, and one other person. But Deborah was the person that Susie was recommending going forward to the board and was ultimately approved by the board. But Vince had been actively interested, screened essentially, and then presented to the president. It was just that Deborah was a better fit at the time.
And the screening committee has not been constituted yet. So Vince is coming to us now because what?
Because Deborah had to resign. They have an immediate need.
I guess the question is why Vince versus someone else? Someone made the decision to present Vince to us now, right?
So that'll be on Chad's shoulders, trying to find the person who is best suited to reflect the knowledge of the Superior Court and the DC Court of Appeals.
Okay, so it wasn't just because he was, you know, the second in the running. It was because Chad looked to see who the screening committee looked at, who else he knew, and felt that Vince was an excellent candidate for this position.
That's exactly right. And frankly, I was heartened to see that that Vince was postured sort of as he was for the very same position that he'd actually be accepting if he's appointed here. In that sense, it was kind of like a warm blanket. It's hard to imagine, although again, there are so many things you'd like to see in a candidate. Some skills and background are very difficult to find, of course, in someone who's willing to do the work, but it was really comforting to see that, and not surprising, frankly, that Vince was sitting in a good position even in 2019. And frankly, I was very grateful that he remained committed and interested in service through the commission today.
Thank you. Well, not knowing him, I take a lot of comfort in the fact that he was a finalist from the screening committee, the prior screening committee, and that you, Chad, know him and have comfort in his qualifications and background and understand the urgency that it sounds like the judicial that is being put on us to fill this spot. So I guess I just put out the thought that he seems like an excellent candidate, someone who will do the pressing job that needs to be done. I totally am with Sally and Susie about the other qualifications that we may want to see. And we do have another appointment coming up in December. And maybe, as you say, Bob, it is incumbent on everyone on the board to take heart to those other characteristics that we want and make sure that we have them in our second nominee, and that we make sure that we have folks that we think bring those characteristics and make sure they get in front of the screening committee so that we can have a good choice for our second appointment when that comes up in December.
Yeah, it's really well put, Ellen. It's tough even with two people, so to speak, on the commission to really touch all of the bases that we'd like to touch in terms of presenting our contribution and face of the bar, so to speak, in the context of the commission. But I also think it's incumbent upon all of us to participate in that effort and not just leave it to the screening committee either. So yeah, I hope that this conversation has been helpful to try and identify what we've got, perhaps also what we lack, and maybe where we want to head come the December opportunity. All of that said, or if there aren't any other questions, I'd entertain a vote now to accept the appointment of Vince Cohen as the bar's nominee for the Judicial Nomination Commission.
Awesome.
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Second.
Hearing a second, all those in favor, please raise your hand, say aye.
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 Any opposed? All right. With that, Zen, thank you very much for that thoughtful discussion. I think we're at the point of our treasurer's report.
All right.
Your stage, Andrea.
Yes, thank you. And I realized when I introduced myself, I didn't actually say my name. That's Andrea Mangonis. So again, nice to meet everyone. I believe there are some slides that should be shared with everyone that I am not to be driving.
Yes, I'm trying to get them up on the screen now. Okay. This is Lisa, just one second.
And I can just start with my brief introduction. First, I want to thank Marg with my deepest gratitude for all the work she did to help prepare this report and the financials. And I'm reporting on the financial results for the bar through May 2021. These were distributed as part of the meeting materials. And if you're looking at the PDF that Crystal sent on Friday, these begin on PDF page 44. If you've got the electronic links up, it's tab 7 in the online materials. The bar's finances remain strong and well ahead of budget as we approach the end of the fiscal year. Here from this first slide are the key takeaways from the memo. The bar, which this is including license fee funded and non-license fee funded activity, ended May with a surplus from operations of $3 million. Versus the budgeted deficit of $195,000. So overall, total revenue is on budget. License fees are better than budget by $252,000, with late fees and penalties continuing to exceed budget, and that's more than offsetting shortfalls from inactive license fees. registrations related to the mandatory course, CLE, and communities events. Those are significantly less than budget due to pandemic-related cancellation of in-person events. The increase in the on-demand mandatory course has helped offset that lack of revenue. The bar's expenses were overall better than budget by 9%. Those savings are primarily pandemic-related in expected categories like food and beverage and travel. It also includes building-related costs and deferral of certain fees and costs, such as professional and IT license fees. The JDC bar's cash balance surged to end the month with a balance of $12 million. That was due to the beginning of the fiscal year 2022 license renewal cycle that started May 3rd. The bar's investments gained about $110,000 in May, and returns year to date total $3.2 million. Of those, not all of those gains are realized, so that could change with market changes. That brings the bar's investment balance to $16.6 million. $2.8 million of those investment gains are the unrealized gains. So as I said, you know, subject to the market changes and the value of the investment portfolio could go up or down. The bar's lease at 1101 K Street ended on May 31st. I understand that is cause for celebration. We will be recognizing $356,000 in gain in June because we got more sublease rent than initially estimated when vacating the building in 2018. Our final payment for that building will occur on August 1st. Including the investment gains, the bar ended April with an overall surplus of $6.2 million versus budget. And for slide two, when talking about non-license fee funded activities, the communities had a surplus of $87,000 from operations through May. That was better than budget by $123,000, while revenue was worse than budget by 11% across almost all operations revenue lines. Expense savings from vacant positions, food and beverage costs, and credit card fees more than offset the shortfall. CLE had a deficit of $26,000 from operations. That was $23,000 worse than budget, driven primarily, again, by significantly lower registrations due to pandemic-related cancellation of events. Cost savings in all expense categories helped to partially offset revenue shortfall, but it wasn't enough to make up the difference. And non-license fee funded activities, which those are primarily certificates of good standing, sponsorships and royalties related to member benefit affinity programs, generated a surplus of $497,000 from operations that exceeded budget by $182,000. The featured partner of the month program that membership launched continues to be very successful in providing additional revenue. Partners include MyCase, Calm HR, USI, Affinity. Those of you who receive, which should be all of you, the DC Bar emails are probably familiar with some of these partners. The recently added Gallagher, Affinity, and Action Step. They've provided close to $200,000 in member affinity revenue. This concludes my first report as treasurer, and I welcome questions.
That's fabulous. Thanks so much, Andrea. Lots of good news there. Okay, with that, I think we can turn to Bob for your CEO report.
All right. I'm going to share my screen here. Start from the beginning, I hope. Because life is not, you don't have enough PowerPoints as it is. I'm going to give you a PowerPoint. So I want to start off, first of all, by recognizing Jessica Carlson, our Associate Director of Marketing and Communications. She's the one who designed and put together the fabulous redesigned CEO report that you saw in your materials, trying to get away from the less text-dense style to a more readable, give you the data as opposed to all the words in there. This was just a first cut. I think it's going to be even slicker in September, but she did a fabulous job. So Jessica, thank you very much. If there's anything else, by the way, that you want to see in the CEO report, any other operational information, please just let me know. We're happy to include it in there. Okay, So I do want to report to you on the operations of the bar and the Pro Bono Center, because we've made some decisions about how we're going to operate. And I thought that I would share it with you. This is what you're about to see is a subset of what we presented to the staff about a week and a half ago. As I discussed with you before, we have this thing called the Return to 901 Project, 901 4th Street being our address. And in developing the sort of outline of what we were going to do, we came up with the strategic priorities that we were going to focus on, and making all the decisions about how we were going to get staff, members, and visitors back in the building. First and foremost, we were going to prioritize staff physical and emotional safety, make sure we're consistently providing excellent service to members, empower the maximum manager employee flexibility, sort of akin to what Chief Judge Josie Herring was talking about, making sure that there's a lot of flexibility in what they're doing. And of course, maintaining transparency along the way so that the staff, our members, the visitors know what we are doing and why we are doing it. In part, to gather the information we needed to make these decisions, we did a survey. A staff survey was put together by Suzanne Takeuchi, the director of marketing and communications, along with Irem. And we had an amazing response. 129 of our employees responded, which was a response rate of 93.4%, which was great. So tremendous participation. I'm going to share with you just a few of the results to give you a sense of what they're thinking and feeling, which helped inform what we've decided to do. So 84% of our staff are fully vaccinated. 16% are not. And again, these are the people who responded, but it's pretty high. Of the 20 who have not been vaccinated, 6 intend to be, 14 do not. And we didn't ask why, whether they have a religious, medical, or just sort of philosophical objection to the vaccination. But the takeaway is the vast majority of our employees are in fact vaccinated. And that matters to them because, generally speaking, more than 60% are in favor of a requirement that folks in the building be vaccinated. Sort of the flip side of that, of course, is that the majority of our staff are uncomfortable having folks in the building not knowing what their status is, more than half. On the positive side, more than 90% of our staff members reported being very satisfied or very satisfied with the remote work situation. And as we have seen over the past more than year, we are able to meet our programmatic and service responsibilities very effectively in a remote status. Similarly, the managers, 90% of the managers feel satisfied or very satisfied with how the staff are carrying out their responsibilities. So what we know is a lot of people are vaccinated, worried about what's going to be walking into the building. Things are working well remote. And we know before the pandemic that things worked very well in person. So we had those baseline pieces of data. We took all of that, rolled it together in focusing on our strategic goals with guidance from CDC, OSHA, SHRM, DC Department of Health, those staff survey results, best practices, some expert recommendations. And we put together a framework for how we were going to figure all of this out. The executive team unanimously agreed, and I put this in here because it is not all that common that the executive team unanimously agrees on anything, but we did, that we were going to a fully and perpetual hybrid environment where we will be able to do everything both in person and virtually at the same time. That is, all of our services that we provide, our programming and events, the ability to call in or walk in, as well as our volunteer meetings of the Board of Governors, staff, committee meetings, task forces, and the rest. But yet the bar needed to maintain the same core hours of operation. So the building needed to be open in the same hours that it was pre-pandemic. I shared this caution notice with the staff 3 separate times during my presentation of them. I'm only going to give it to you guys once, but that everything that we laid out for them about what hybrid life is going to be like is subject to change. If the COVID levels spike, we could change. If federal local guidance changes, we could change. If our productivity levels slip or change, that could change. And then of course, we'll take staff and member feedback. We wanted to build in an expectation that this was going to have to be a work in progress. And gotta stay flexible. We're giving managers great flexibility in arranging the schedules of their staff in order to meet the needs of what their programmatic responsibilities are. But everything has got to be flexible and subject to change based on how things are going and with lots of constant feedback. So phase one is going to happen in the fall, and we're going to slowly transition back into the building. Unlike the court, where we have like a pressing need to have so many people in, we are in a different environment because we can exist hybrid very successfully. So during phase one, as I mentioned, we'll have hybrid staff operations, primarily remote programming with some limited in-person programming, but everything that we do in person will have a remote option. Right, so everyone will have access. Phase one is going to begin on Monday, October 4th, and will last at least until February of 2022. The reason we're going to start on October 4th is because we want folks to acclimate and develop a new hybrid schedule. We know a lot of our employees have kids who are going to have school issues to figure out when we get to the fall. A big chunk of our folks take public transportation, which is a whole nother piece that we have to figure out. And then we want to monitor the potentially changing circumstances about variants, vaccine, booster requirements, and the rest. And significantly, we want to fine-tune our hybrid programming, because it's one thing when all of us are doing Zoom at the same time. It's another thing when you have seven people sitting in the Board of Governors room looking in one little box. And so we have technology coming that's going to try to address this, but we want to get it right before we roll it out. So we figured between Labor Day and October 4th, we can get everything kind of working. Then October 4th, we can kind of open the doors. During this phase, only fully vaccinated employees are going to be in 901. We know that 85% of them are vaccinated, so we can have the core complement in there. The proof of vaccination status will be made confidentially to HR, or we have an online system that we're thinking about bringing on board. They will not be required to mask. Non-vaccinated employees can work remotely, assuming their jobs permit it. But if there are non-vaccinated employees who have, you know, medical or religious exemptions who do need to come into 901, they can do so, but they're going to have to show proof of their exemption, confirm that they're not experiencing symptoms, pass a same-day COVID test, wear a mask, and socially distance. These are all consistent with CDC recommendations and local DC Department of Health recommendations. The same thing with members and visitors to the building. So in the beginning, we're only going to have vaccinated members and visitors in. They'll have to register in that same confidential online system. We will not receive their vaccination or medical information. We will get a thumbs up or thumbs down from the online registration system about whether they could be in or not in the building. Non-vaccinated members and visitors can attend meetings and programs remotely. And then those who have exemptions can come into the building following the same protocol that we've got for the employees. Show proof of the exemption through the online system, confirm they're not experiencing COVID symptoms, pass a rapid test, and wear a mask and socially distance. And of course, we will limit the number of people who can be in programs or meetings who are not vaccinated. We also have a return to 901 committee, I've mentioned this before, that is working to put in place the actual mechanical procedures. How you check in the building, how many people in a room, what the technology is going to look like, what the audiovisual links are going to be, and the rest. And that's what they are working on right now. And we've already seen, like, for example, a couple of vendors for the online registration system, one of which the Aspen Institute uses for their programs, which we kind of like, but we're still figuring all that stuff out. So that is what our plan is. And that's going to take us at least till February, and we'll monitor conditions. Our hope is that things will continue to improve and not get worse in the winter months. The variants will prove to be not resistant to the vaccinations or boosters. And then we can have more in-person programming as we're going forward into 2022. But slow going, because we're effective at doing it both ways, in person and remote, and on a hybrid basis. I will pause here before I go into my next topic area to see if anybody has any questions about our operational plans at this point. Susie?
Thanks, Bob. This was really great. Thank you so much. And the presentation, Jessica, was excellent, so thank you. Pre-pandemic or pre-remote operations, what extent did like clients and client community members entered the physical building, or most of that interaction was always offsite?
Most of it was offsite. We have some, obviously, some client contact. And of course, we have a tenant in the building who, you know, Rising for Justice, and they do have folks come in the building. And so we're kind of limited, their tenants, and what we can require them to do. But we intend to follow all the same guidelines, even for visitors in the building. Now, that doesn't mean to say that we won't have unvaccinated people coming in. It just means we're going to have to make sure that we've got the boxes checked. And we've talked about things like, there's a CVS at the corner at 4th and Massachusetts Avenue, 400 Mass Ave, of maybe trying to work out something with them where they could administer the rapid tests for people wanting to come in the building sort of as they're coming in to get that information. So those protocols are still very much being worked out. And of course, we still have the ability to meet with folks remotely the same way that we've been doing so before. So we're not going to be limiting any services or any opportunities that we have. We are going to have to sort of figure out a little bit about the way that they look. Other questions? All right. With that, I do want to go to another topic, which is license renewal. As you know, in 2 days, technically speaking, the late fee period of the license renewal cycle will be in place. So we are pretty far along. And I just want to let you know that as of this morning, we've collected about $24.3 million in license fees, which is 78% of our budget, which is good. We got about $6 million or so to go, almost $7 million to go. We've got $1.3 million collected in communities memberships, which is 85% of our budget, and significantly $1.5 million in pro bono contributions just from the license renewal period, which is more than 20% higher than it was this time last year. And the average contribution is bumped up, as you see, from 119 to 123, which is absolutely fabulous. The credit card surcharge that we put in place this year has already recovered $430,000 in credit card surcharge fees, which is money that we used to pay out of license fees to cover those costs. So far, that is great. You can see in the bottom that last year we had 2.8% roughly folks using ACH, direct bank deposits. This year it's gone up to 14.3%, which also fabulous, which means our members are getting the message, they're figuring out how to do it, and then those are the folks not incurring the extra fees. So all in all, we're doing really well. We've not seen any significant, we're within a couple of percentage points on each of these items, but for pro bono, which we're significantly ahead, with exactly where we were last year. So everything is marching right along. We haven't seen any significant drop off in members or people resigning or going inactive. Nothing different than what we'd experienced in our usual year. Okay. With that, I am going to stop sharing my screen and ask Darren to update you all, give you an after-action report, if you will, on the celebration of leadership.
Hey, folks. How's everybody today? I know we've been at this for about 2 hours now, so I'm going to go real quick through this. We had a great celebration of leadership on Thursday, June 24th. Of course, the evening started off with the president's reception at 5 o'clock and rolled pretty much right into celebration of leadership at 5:30, and it ended at 6:30. This really was a true cross-departmental collaboration event. We had folks from programs, community, CLE, Reg Council, as well as our colleagues in communications, and especially IT, who helped us troubleshoot and test our virtual event platform in the run-up to the event. As a result, the IT worked flawlessly, and the only customer service issues we had were designated as user error, and even those were fixed very quickly. And thanks to all of you who served on our host committee and helped promote the event. We had 580 folks registered. Unfortunately, there was a drop-off in actual attendance, 342 actually logged in, which was down a bit from previous year. And we think it's just a function of people being you know, in a virtual environment for a year and how much more competition there is out there for their time right now. But still, 342 was good. And it was a free event, so there were no registration fees. But we did hit our target of $15,000 in sponsorships, and we ended up coming in about $10,000 under budget. So that was good. We had folks tuning in from four different countries and across the United States. And our post-event surveying saw ratings of mostly excellent, which were actually very high for any of our courses. What attendees liked best were the video presentations, hearing from the incoming and outgoing presidents, and of course, our master of ceremony, Greg Williams, who came back for a second year. People really liked it a lot. They also liked the streamlined format. So the hour-long format really worked well. Folks appreciated the that it wasn't really too much of a drain on their time. We got them in, we got them out, and it moved very, very well, I thought. The event is posted for those of you who missed it on the DC Bar's YouTube channel. There's a link under news and events on our webpage. And now it's full steam ahead for the 2022 50th anniversary celebration, which will be on Thursday, June 23rd. And thank goodness, because this has been a heck of a year with four of our signature events in the last 12 months. At least now we can really focus on what's coming up for next summer. So that's it. Any questions?
Yep. Just again, a huge thanks to you and your team, Darren. It takes a lot to make Jeff and I look and sound good. So that's a challenge here.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Darren. And I have one last bit of very good news. As most of you know, the bar has eight floors, seven of which we use all the time, but we have one vacant floor, the seventh floor. And believe it or not, and at the risk of jinxing everything before the final lease is signed, we have a tenant for the seventh floor. The College of William and Mary has signed a letter of intent, and we are currently negotiating the final terms of a lease for a big, not the entire seventh floor, but a big chunk of the seventh floor, where they're going to be hosting their Washington semester program and doing a bunch of alumni events. So they want to move fast. They want to be built out by the beginning of 2022. So with all keeping my fingers and toes crossed, we will actually have a tenant on the seventh floor.
Lucky number seven, well done.
Yeah.
So particularly in this environment.
And then there's like so much vacant office space in the District of Columbia right now. It's like a record-setting vacancies. So Matt Butler deserves an enormous amount of credit for pushing our agents to find just the right tenant and making the right deal at the right time. The bank was so elated. Our bank rep took Marg and Matt out for drinks to celebrate. So,
cheers, Matt and Marg.
It's big news. It's very big.
Well done.
All right. With that, it's back to you, Chad.
Okay. Then without further ado, why don't we turn to our general counsel, who's got a little bit of the business we previewed before with regard to some bylaws that need some adjustment.
Sure. And this is, again, carrying on the theme that some of you have already heard from Chad and June about how bylaws need not be encumbered with lots of detail. And this is a perfect example of that. For many of you, you'll recall last year in July and September, the Board of Governors approved a suspension of the bylaws that required a late fee if license fees were not received by the July 15th deadline, and then also an administrative suspension that would kick in as of September 30th if those fees were not paid. The waiver or the suspension of the bylaws last year then allowed the staff and the CEO discretion to waive the late fee and also defer the administrative suspension to December 31st or in some instances to March 31st if a member let us know in time that their inability to pay was due to the COVID-19 pandemic. We had about 10 requests last year, and we have so far about 15 this year. So it's not a huge burden, but it's something that you know, we'd like to be able to do for members while we can. And then again, this is something that shouldn't take up the board's time. This is something that staff should be able to determine and kind of implement at a moment's notice. And so what we're asking is for the board to extend that suspension, or what I'd like to call it is the authorization for the CEO to have discretion to waive the late fee and defer the suspension for instances where people have been impacted financially by the pandemic. I'm happy to answer any questions. The papers are in front of you, so I don't want to belabor that any further. And that is all for now. Go ahead, Susie. Yeah.
It's less about the technical issue about the bylaws, but more about whether or not, I don't recall last time, whether or not, is this announced in some form that people can do this, or bar members can do this?
I see Bob looking to speak.
Yeah, it's okay. So what we decided last year is that we were not going to sort of preemptively, proactively advertise the fact that you can just delay your payment. Instead, as people inquired, we would let them know that it was available. And that's what's been going on. So as people would contact member services and say, hey, I can't pay, or I may not, or is there an exemption? Then we let them know, oh yes, you can go ahead and do it. And because we're now at the July 13th, and this all takes part on the 15th, we've been sort of having folks essentially get ready to sign. I mean, they've already let us know, but we don't have the power to do anything. We've let them know that if you tell us that you're seeking one of these deferrals, we'll let you know following this meeting whether they have been renewed again, and then we'll go ahead and implement them. But we've not, because we didn't have the power to advertise, nor did we want to do it in a way that would then maybe allow people to take advantage of it, you know, unfair advantage of it, not necessary advantage of it. But as if people inquire, we've been telling them that it happened last year. We're asking the board for permission to do it this year, and we'll let you know.
Yeah, I must admit, I have mixed feelings about it, because on the one hand, I totally get where you don't want people taking advantage of it. But on the other hand, I kind of feel like, ugh. So some people just may not think to ask, and so they may be struggling and don't realize they can take advantage of this. I don't know if there's something can say, hey, if you're struggling with this, please contact us so we can have a discussion. You know, I don't know if there's some kind of, after we have the vote.
So the thing is that we don't have the power to even do that until you give us the power.
Right, no, I meant after the vote. Yeah. Is that something that could happen?
I mean, well, I guess we could figure out what a message might be that would not, because now it's, we still have the suspension piece of this to worry about, right, between now and September. So we can, in fact, you know, if you're struggling, contact us. I mean, we could do something along those lines once you give us the authorization to go ahead.
Yeah, particularly with the communications regarding late payment, that, you know, you're overdue. It would be great if within that, I mean, I think particularly newer bar members who are most likely to struggle to pay are not going to think to reach out to ask if there's any way they could avoid the fee.
Well, so it sounds like we're almost putting a cart before a horse here, right? It sounds like there's a lot of support for what we need to do, and then we need to discuss how we implement from there. So maybe with that, I'll just see if there is a motion to approve the authority that we've discussed here. And let me say, just thank you again here for that very helpful explanation.
So moved.
Second. Is there a second? I hear a second. Okay, all those in favor, please raise your hand and say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Aye. All right. So with that, then, with that approval in hand, maybe what we can do is just consider offline a bit of a proposal that might look like some kind of a public announcement, or at least a limited announcement to those who appear to be in a position where they might need this, folks who are already late, and take that up at our, I guess it can't be our next meeting, but do we think we want a special session, perhaps?
I think that what we can do is we can go ahead and let the staff craft that message, because we'll need to figure out whether where it makes sense to do that, given
there are options.
Way our license registration system works and the communications works also. We have an email go out today, for example, the last one, reminding folks that we have a suspension date 2 days from now. So, or a late fee date 2 days from now. So why don't you let us craft this, and then we can move forward from there.
Makes good sense to me. Yeah, I like the sound of that. Okay, so with that, I think we're at that point of our agenda where we should adjourn our public session and turn to our second executive session.
Chad, do you think folks might need 5 minutes to stretch for, we've been out of this for 2 hours now.
I think that's good sense, sure. So I've got 2:06 on my calendar. Why don't we come back at, I don't know, 2:11, 2:12?
It's good.
Excellent. See you in a few.